And watching the news these days, there's lots of top cover happening over the Straits of Hormuz. And, well, that Middle Eastern situation continues to fester and bubble and boil like a witch's cauldron. And we don't have any idea of what where this is heading. But I heard some rather alarming news that, according to one very well-placed analyst, we could be looking at this thing escalating quite dramatically. So we won't go there today. We're going to be talking about something much friendlier, much happier. And I alluded to the fact that my special guest this morning was an expert in the field of solar. And I wasn't lying. He's Warwick Chapman is in the house. Thank you for joining me on the, well, this used to be the morning show, but now the Dave Charles Show.
Thanks, Dave.
So, nice, you know, we chatted briefly last week, and you said, apparently you're an interesting guy. That's why I've asked you to come in. And you are a very interesting guy. And I thought before we segue into the world of solar, which you're an expert at, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to ask you about it, you've also got a very, very good handle on the world of politics in South Africa. And the news this weekend that the Democratic Alliance has finally appointed a new leader, Jordan Hill Lewis. I thought I might take the opportunity to ask you about that because, well, I have an idea that you might know. Certainly you knew John Steenhuisen and you worked closely with him. Do you know Jordan Hill Lewis?
Yeah, we worked very closely together as well during my time there. And we socialized and we had briars together and that kind of thing. So, you know, Jordan is a incredibly good human being. And he really genuinely cares about what he does and the people that he serves and represents in a way that I think we all wish it still existed in the public service. When it comes to setting the tone from the top, he's exactly the right kind of person for that sort of thing. But I think the other important thing about this weekend's news is if you look at the rest of that leadership cohort that was elected, it's young, it's extremely diverse, it's very exciting, I think. And a lot of those people were also my peers at the time when I was there. And they are all really good and exciting people. So I think it's a really big step forward for the Democratic Alliance. I think Helen's campaign in Johannesburg is getting some real traction. And there's a huge prospect of something big happening there. So I think we've got a very interesting time in front of us.
Do you miss not being actively involved in politics?
I do. Politics is extremely enjoyable and rewarding. And it's interesting because it ebbs and flows and, you know, you have these completely manic election campaign type cycles where it builds up to this incredible crescendo and then you have a couple of years of slow build until it happens again. But the public service part of it and trying to make things work, trying to build things, trying to fix things, that's part of my DNA. Whether I'm in politics or not, that's what I enjoy doing. So I do miss it. I made a decision before my kids were born that politics and young families weren't good together. And for better or worse, for better for my family, for worse for my political career, or if I was good at it, for public service. I'll stay out of it until my kids are a bit older, and that very important young period of the kids' lives I've been around for.
Ah, well, that's noble, but of course, sad for the country because I think you've got the right stuff. And generally speaking, the fact that you were heavily involved with the Democratic Alliance and in the heart of the machine, so to speak, would have put you right up at the top of the pops, and we could be seeing you as the new leader this morning. But be that as it may, we're very fortunate in this area that you've entered local politics, even as a kind of the what was a residence, KDRF residence forum that you head. That's a civic action and applying lots of, I think, intelligent pressure where it counts. And there are many issues to discuss, and hopefully we will get into that at a later stage. But I want to sort of circle back now to your other field of expertise, which is solar.
Yeah.
Because solar has so many aspects to it that I think people are vaguely familiar with, but not intimately connected to. And as a result, I think that it's fair to say that there's been quite a lot of misinformation around the field of solar energy and the affordability of solar energy and the ease of access, etc., etc. So I thought, let's take the opportunity to speak to you because your organization, Sensible Solar, has a wonderful reputation for honest service, systems that work with support guarantees, etc. And I think that that is something that... well, you can certainly be proud of.
Thank you.
And we like to acknowledge these things because we're looking at points of excellence, generally speaking, in our Bolito Connect collection of top-performing businesses and services. And you're right up at the top there when it comes to solar. So let's get into it and find out from you, what inspired you to start a solar electricity business?
Well, at the time that I left the Democratic Alliance, I needed to move on to something else. My career up until then had been dominated largely by sitting in front of a computer, with the exception of a few years as a ward councillor in Itakwini, where I was in the field a lot and in meetings a lot. But otherwise, the first decade of my life after school, I'd founded and run an IT business, which I sold to my partner when I joined the Democratic Alliance and became a councillor, and he still runs that business today. And he's one of Sensible Solar's customers, happy customers. So IT is a big interest area. Solar, I believe one of the reasons why Sensible has a good reputation is because in order to fully understand and properly leverage solar, you also need to be a bit of an IT geek. And we see this quite often. People have had solar systems installed by electricians who are electricians and not network and IT people. And then when the question gets asked, can you give me an analysis of how my system is performing and whether I should be upgrading or otherwise optimizing? It's a very difficult question for Joe, electrician, to answer. And so because we've been able to combine those two strengths, I think we've been able to provide an extremely high level of service. And it's also just interesting to me. I can watch videos about electrical engineering and electronic engineering and tinker and build little systems and boards. I love it. So you follow your interest.
Your passion. Lucky to have found a passion that pays. Was there ever a moment that you can identify that you realized that renewables, solar in particular, was a future?
Well, it's interesting because the first system that I installed was, because I was on the campaign trail all the time, when my son was born, I was around for 3 weeks in the first 3 months of his life. It was really horrible. And there was load shedding, and I was worried about my wife at home alone with this kid and not having power and whatever. So I installed our first solar system. And she never, to this day, has ever had to worry about being without power. It's such an anomaly in our household that the kids have a cadenza and it's a disaster on the one or two or three instances over the last 6 years or 7 years that there hasn't been any power. It made it clear to me that you've got this untapped resource in the sky, and if your system is designed properly and you don't overload it, you can run forever on the sun.
What was the biggest challenge getting your company off the ground?
You know, Dave, I think there's basically been two challenges, and I'm now embarking on the third one. The first one was that the company was born just before COVID and was killed by COVID, and then we rebirthed it again in June 2020. And at that time, load shedding was starting to become really serious. 2020, 2021, 2022, the height of load shedding was 2023. We grew to a network of 5 branches around the country and 75 staff in those 4 years. And it was absolutely frenetic. It was the classic example of move fast and break things. We really had a hard time keeping up. And we did our very best. And at the core of it, regardless, doesn't matter what was going on in the back room or whatever, customer service, look after your clients, respond to those WhatsApps, answer those phone calls, all that kind of stuff. Making sure that people always had power was our obsession. But we made quite a lot of mess in the meantime. Then phase two was 2024 and 2025. Load shedding had been solved. Demand had fallen off of a cliff. The GNU sent huge jitters into the economy. People weren't sure about investing money. And Sensible did not, from a business perspective, respond sensibly. We, I'm 100% responsible. We kept the team on for too long. We tried to protect them for too long, believing that the economy was going to rebound, that demand for solar was going to rebound. And we burned through everything that we had made in the previous years. And we ended up in trouble last year. Enter phase three. We have a new shareholder. We aren't in trouble in any way, shape, or form. We're in an incredibly good position. And phase three is now consolidate, move forward, grow, but now down to a team of 25 and a single branch here in KZN.
Okay, good point of pause. We'll take a little musical breather and be back with Warwick Chapman from Sensible Solar on the flip side of this one. And we're back with my special guest, Warwick Chapman, who is, hello, that was a very loud interlude, playing with the buttons. We're talking solar. We're talking his company, Sensible Solar, is one of the most reputable of its kind in certainly this area, but it has been a national organization. And now focus particularly on the KZN situation. Let's take a look at the average homeowner's requirements, because it is so difficult to know where to begin. There are many messages coming to you from various directions in the media, many of them talking about price only, some talking about reliability, and very few talking about what really needs to happen.
Yeah. Well, price is a big thing, and there's a lot of cheap stuff on the market. And as is more and more the case, we see this with automobiles, the cheap stuff on the market, particularly the Chinese manufactured stuff, is getting quite good these days. In the automotive market, I think the Chinese cars are really upsetting the apple cart among the established European and Japanese manufacturers, and Korean. And in the solar market, there is also really good kit. But getting high quality support on it and getting that really deep analysis and being able to understand when things go wrong, why they've gone wrong, and being able to get the right kind of information to know that when I want to upgrade or when should I upgrade, whatever. We find that that those products are not anywhere near as good as the kit that we use. So
you don't recommend the cheaper Chinese gear?
We don't. Where clients insist on it, we install it. But it comes with T's and C's. We genuinely can't support it as well as we can the European stuff that we use. We can't remote manage it. We can't remote monitor it.
But if your client's on a budget, and I presume most people are, particularly at the moment, while you've got the optimal systems, and those are clearly more expensive. I'm not going to gild that lily, and you get what you pay for. But you will look at a more cost affordable option, even though you may not be able to support it.
Well, we will never run away from an installation that we've done. The difference is for our Victron clients. Victron is the Dutch brand that we predominantly install. We can troubleshoot and resolve most things remotely. Whereas if you have a problem on one of the other inverters, we probably have to get in the car and come out.
Oh.
And so there's a latency in time for us to get there. There's a charge related to the call out and whatever. So the service experience, the support experience just isn't as good. But absolutely, they are cheaper. And where clients want them, we install them. It just comes... You know, I've learned over the years when it comes to customer service that the most important thing is to set the correct expectations up front in writing. Because often the issue will emerge in 3 or 4 years' time, and then it's a vague memory of, oh no, but you said, but I said. We need to be able to say up front, no problem, we'll install this brand of inverter. Please just understand that we can't do X, Y, and Z, and the data that we see is delayed by 5 minutes, and so on and so forth. And so if there's a problem, we may have to come out, and that call out will be chargeable, etc., etc. And then at least the ground rules are laid and everyone's accepted them up front, and they can be referred to 3 or 4 years down the line if necessary. In the absence of that, customer service is quite a fraught experience.
Okay, moving on from there... Practically, looking at the average household, and I'm not necessarily talking Belita only, because there might be a bit of a higher net worth individual in this area proportionate to the rest of the area. What would be a kind of average starting point that you could comfortably get into an element of solar? I'm not saying it would take your whole house off, but to start working and finding the benefits of it.
For us, it's about 100,000 Rand. That's the starting point. You can certainly deploy solutions that are smaller than that. But for us to get our guys in a van and the vehicle on the road, and there's also a sort of minimum project size that's worth it for getting our team out, and that may offend some, but it's also the reality. Yeah. Our job is... In it's really important, this idea. When we started our business, panel prices were 3 times higher than they are now. Inverter prices were 3 times, battery prices were 3 times higher. Our margin, at the same margin that we pay now, was triple 3 years ago that we were earning now. And it's really important for us to run a sustainable business, because we can't support our customers into the years that come if we aren't profitable. And so we do have to make tough decisions like that to make sure that we can look after the clients that we've made promises to.
So if the starting point is around 100K, is it not a tough... I suppose in this training, almost showing a return on investment to a smallish installation that has paid out 100,000 Rand, it sounds like it's quite a tall ask, is it?
Well, if you want the ROI, the return on investment, to be purely in terms of electricity saved, it's going to be a tough ask, because a smaller system is going to be harder to get that ROI from, because of all of the associated costs of just getting the team there and getting the installation done. But I would ask people to consider that ROI isn't purely cash-based. It's also about what it does to your life and your sanity and your family and your marriage. I'm serious. We hear a lot about marriages in our business, okay? The decision,
because of power shortages.
The decision about whether or not the aircon is going to be on backup is a marital matter, okay? I think we've done a lot for marriages over the years. Let's just say that much. Jokes aside, families spend an inordinate amount of money on cars. without batting an eyelid. But come to solar, and we must scrutinize the ROI to the nth degree. This solar decision is now getting the rational decision maker applied to it. But buying a car, it's just all emotion, and it's fine. It doesn't matter how much it costs. And I would appeal to people to understand that that 100,000 rand is a pittance compared to what most people are willing to spend on cars.
I suppose the car gives you the acceptance, recognition, status that one craves as a human being. You know, love is at the top of that one, but we very seldom get that. Acceptance, recognition, status, there we go. And driving a car gives you all of that. Solar, not necessarily, because you don't really see it.
Yeah, sure.
So it's a bit like insurance or tires, or you need to talk about cars. It's so important, really, in the scheme of things, in terms of living and comfortable living.
Yeah.
But it's not sexy in the sense that it gives you all of that recognition and status and acceptance and love. Yep. That a fashion brand might give you. So you're appealing more to, I would imagine, those that have already given it some thought and decided, for lifestyle purposes predominantly, we want a lifestyle that is unaffected by the vagaries of Eskom and the local municipality and. For 100,000 Rand, is it how far off the grid? And I'm talking about for how long, if the power is down, municipal power or national power, could you keep a household going?
So you could keep the household going for as long as you want. Okay, it's a how long is a piece of string question, because if you genuinely and diligently use only the lights and the TV and the internet in the house, even on a cloudy day like today, the solar panels will generate enough to keep that going and to charge your battery a bit to get you through the next day and the next day when the sun comes out in full force. But if you ignore the limitations of your power system and you turn your aircon on, you know, within a few hours you could run that battery flat. So it depends how you live. My favorite jobs of all are clients who go completely off-grid. And the ultimate favorite is clients who physically disconnect from the grid. They already have been on the grid and they've decided to disconnect and move off-grid. And that is as much about the technical solution that we implement as it is about their lives and how they live them and their relationship with energy consumption. And so in Fairview, for example, we have quite a lot of clients now who are going off-grid or have built their houses off-grid from the beginning. And you think completely differently about the architecture of the house and about the services in the house. And
but you say off-grid. Is it practical to go entirely off-grid?
Dave, there are families, young families, living in Fairview, running on systems that cost 100, 200, 300,000 rand, completely off-grid. They never lose
power. So they never have to worry about an electricity, an outage, or a bill that is going to be... Because people at the moment are concerned tremendously about, well, we know the diesel price has gone north badly. We know that Eskom has been burning through diesel here at the Peking plant, up the road, millions of litres. Mm-hmm. It's going to definitely affect the price of electricity going forward, and it can... You know, it's a bit of a nightmare scenario because the average household budget is set. You know, that's what it is. And suddenly you've now got to start budgeting for a hell of a lot more in terms of electricity. What we're talking about now, you mean you can actually eliminate all of that worry? Is there not a downside to being off the grid? There must be.
Well, there's a downside in that you are your own producer, your own power producer. So if something fails with your system, you have no power until someone comes and fixes it. But that will happen far less frequently over the period that you own the system than normal grid power outages happen. And if you do have a generator, and most off-grid systems do have a standby generator, if that ever happens, you can start the genny and run off of the genny. But there are families, like I've mentioned about in the previous examples, who have actually developed systems that don't have generators integrated with. And they've accepted that in the event that they run out of battery power, that they're going to be without electricity for a little while. That's part of the way that they've chosen to live.
So the different, slightly different way of thinking.
Different way of thinking.
Do they also think a little bit more about leaving lights on and things like that?
Absolutely. Being energy conscious just becomes written into the DNA of families like that. And it's also, it's not just leaving lights on and things. It's like, tonight we're not going to have the roast that we said we were going to have. We're going to cook something else because the batteries are only at half, right? And so, you know, a lot of people turn their noses up at that and say, there's no way that I'm going to have my day determined by whether or not the battery's full. Well, then living off-grid is not for you.
So it's, in a sense, a little bit of pioneering and a little bit left of center. And to a degree, I suppose it's fair to say, it's not for everyone, but for those that are prepared to weigh the benefits and the threats and the opportunities and the risks, and it comes out looking good, then solar, off-grid solar, could well be a solution. However, if you want to still, as a safety, have yourself connected to, how close are we to a system that puts electricity back into the grid from a solar installation?
Well, there's only really good government standing between us and feeding into the grid.
So it's possible.
Technically, it's completely possible.
Wow. Let's take a breather and we'll come back and chat about that on the flip side. Monday morning, I'm in conversation with Warwick Chapman from Sensible Solar. And we were talking about the practicality of pumping electricity back into the grid. Because I know that there was some talk a while back. I remember when we were looking in the early days of this whole energy crisis thing, and I looked at a homeowners association in Parkhurst in Johannesburg, where they had actually successfully managed to network a lot of homes in Parkhurst, and they were supplying electricity to adjacent areas that were sort of lower income that were battling. And I thought, wow, how innovative, and I wonder if there's going to be a thing. But clearly, there are issues.
So at a municipal level, the municipality is not prepared, doesn't have the tariffs, doesn't have the smart meters, etc., for us to be able to feed into the grid and be credited from it. But there are some microgrids in the area, or subgrids. There are, I mentioned Fairview earlier, there are a couple of others in the Salt Rock area, where the estate owns the bulk meter and they're able to manage some grid feed in on the inside of their bulk meter. So there are a few places in the area where it's done, but it's done it's done on the inside of the KDM meter. And it's perfectly legal and it's perfectly technically possible to feed into KDM's grid. It's just a function of KDM being organized enough to install the meters and be able to credit us for feeding excess power into the grid.
Where do you see solar going? Is equipment improving? What is the most exciting bit of technology that you can think of right now that's an innovation?
Solar panels are a bit like tires on cars. They can get incrementally better, but it doesn't seem like there's going to be any great leaps forward anytime soon. Inverters are also pretty mature, and it doesn't seem like we're going to have huge advances. But storage is the big opportunity. We currently have an extremely good standard in the market in lithium iron phosphate batteries. They're very safe. They're extremely stable. They last well into the sort of 10 plus years. They use lots of minerals and metals and things that are hard to mine and expensive and environmentally damaging and all those sorts of things. And they can, if they're exposed to extremely high temperatures, like if they are inside a building that's burning, they can then reach thermal runaway point and further fuel that fire. They don't themselves combust, but if they are exposed to extremely high temperatures, they become dangerous. So there are quite a lot of I mean, and the storage question isn't just about what you and I would put in our homes, because these lithium iron phosphate batteries are really, really good for that. It's also about how do we build huge grid scale batteries, because one of the good things about wind and solar is that they're incredibly cheap. So say 50 cents a kilowatt hour. Now we know that we're paying R3.30 or something a kilowatt hour here. Solar and wind levelized cost of ownership of the energy is somewhere around about 50 cents a kilowatt hour. What we want to do is we want to store that energy in batteries and use it when solar or wind is not there, because they are variable. And so really, really big grid scale batteries are part of the future. And there's some really interesting stuff happening in storage, like the Gauteng is full of mine shafts. So what they do is they take weights and they put them on a rope, and the rope's connected to a generator, and they lower the weight down into the mine shaft, and that generates electricity. And then they take it off and they store it, and then they pull the thing back up and add another weight to it, and they do that at nighttime. And then during the day, when there's excess solar, they use that solar to pull the weights up, back up the mine shaft. Okay,
and that's happening,
and that's one of the experiments that's underway in order to create what's called a gravity battery.
And the experiments that have been conducted in terms of wave and literal action, the action of the ocean waves generating power, is that something that has been looked at here?
I haven't seen any wave energy experiments in South Africa. Our coastline, I think, is pretty vicious. There are parts of the world where it works, but you know, those things need to be incredibly robust, and as such they're very, very expensive and hard to maintain and all that kind of stuff. But there's concentrated solar, where they've got not solar panels but effectively mirrors that are all angled to focus on a specific point, like the magnifying glass and the ant. And they actually melt salt, or they melt sand, and that molten sand is then stored until nighttime, and then it's used to heat water and power a turbine and generate electricity until the morning, where the sand can be molten again.
So despite the fact that it looks like the world is full of people wanting to blow it up, there are actually people that are looking at technology from a point of view of making life better on the planet for people.
Yeah, every day. And the AI revolution, it's a big deal. It's probably the biggest technological shift that we will experience in our lifetimes. And that's saying something, because we were alive to see the birth of the internet. And the AI revolution is the most power-hungry thing humans have ever done, by far. And that power is largely going to need to be supplied by either renewable sources, or it seems by nuclear, a combination of renewables and nuclear.
So energy is going to be in demand for an awfully long time. In fact, it always has been, but it's getting more and more valuable as the time goes by. And solar is becoming, I think, more and more desirable. Certainly from my conversation with you this morning, it's answered a number of questions. One, of course, burning question for anyone listening to this wanting to find out more: how do they get hold of you?
Well, WhatsApp on 083-7797094, or sales@sensible.co.za.
And we've been in conversation with Warwick Chapman. Makes a lot of sense, and clearly it's a conversation that needs to be had. And if you've been having this conversation at home or in the workplace and are looking for some really good advice, I would suggest that Warwick is available to give you good advice. Take it or not, you know, use it or don't. It's entirely up to you. But the opportunity, I think, has never been better. And Warwick, thanks so much for spending the valuable time that we have taken to get your points of view across. But I think valuable indeed is our stock in trade. So thanks again.
Thank you.
This will be up as a podcast. If you've missed most of it, you can catch it up on demand, listening on demand on our apps or our website. And the Dave Charles Show continues.